Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Rallycast, episode 4 of season 2. I'm JP, wearing something other than a black t-shirt, got a logo on it. Should hopefully tell you a little bit about the topic of today, but I'm obviously joined by Carl, our co-host, and a very wonderful guest for today's session. We are still on the Imagine If series, and pretty excited, actually, for the conversation we're about to have. We've been kind of getting together and discussing over the last month, and our 10-15 minute chats have turned into 1 hour sessions on their own. So just really eager, really excited. But for those of you who this may be the first episode that you're watching, again, my name is Jean-Paul. Been hosting these now since day one. So it's going to save the repeat listeners a little bit about me. But Carl, this is your second episode as a co-host. So introduce yourself a little bit to our new listeners, and then we'll hand over to our wonderful guest, Sean.
Absolutely. Thanks, JP. Yeah, happy to be here. Second episode. Been at IP Rally about a year and a half. You know, my background is actually a bit mixed between kind of tech and IP in the software space. Spent a little bit of time at Clarivate, working in the Derwent product there, but worked for companies like Apple and Sonos and others. Have been doing this at IP Rally now for about a year and a half, managing commercial sales on the Western North American continent, pretty much mostly the United States, up in the Silicon Valley is really where all the action is. But really
that's,
happy to be here.
That's the day job. That's the day job.
Yeah, that's the day job.
I think the Carl After Dark is what's really going to be driving today's episode. Outstanding musician. Music
yes,
lover.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I've had a parallel career as a professional musician as well. So it's a lot to juggle, but it's really fun. You know, those when those worlds kind of intersect, that's the most exciting part of it. So, you know, really happy to be here to have this conversation. Happy to have you, Sean. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
And I'm really excited to get into it.
Yeah, and we're joined by Sean Clark, who's also a music lover. Maybe a Swiftie, potentially, but
certainly a Swiftie. So yeah. I can.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Sean.
Sure. Yeah. Currently, vice president for media licensing at Adia. You know, Adia is a company that has been innovating in over 30 years, and how you know, users basically consume media across billions of devices. I'm here strictly as a music fan and in a personal capacity. Been in licensing for a long time. I think that's maybe going to shade some of my focus here today. Previously worked at Rovi, TiVo, and Tessera, which were all predecessor companies to Adia. A bit of a boomerang. Previous to that, I was at Ericsson and have worked at Microsoft Intellectual Ventures and you know, various other intellectual property companies over the last couple of years.
Wonderful. Sean, we're very excited, and you know, thank you for taking the time out for today. And the premise of this series is Imagine If. We've had guests talking about the importance of the open innovation around AI and some of the limitations. We've spoke with you know, your friend, my friend, and former colleague Sam Wiley around the importance of looking back and making decisions and having confidence in our knowledge, let's say, as industry experts and thought leaders to maybe drive what we're thinking. And for today, Imagine If, we're leaving it a little bit open, but it's really around some of the main important topics of how the best way to say it is ensuring that creators get their due, but also ensuring that the system is enabling this next wave of creation, really. So today's topic is going to be very nerdy, as always, hopefully, but it's going to be around essentially, how can we ensure that a Disney versus Midjourney or an opportunity to file any IP license out trickles down to the creators? How can we change that? How can we enforce that? What mechanisms can we put in place? What mechanisms are in place, etc.? So, yeah, without further ado, let's jump in with the main content. Carl, you brought up an interesting episode from last week tonight around AI slop. And I think it's important to understand, you know, we're not talking about a cat walking down and, you know, replicating KISS. It's all the way back to the beginning of music samples. You know, how can you ensure that a musician gets credit for their sample being used, let's say, by Daft Punk, or if you're using a small amount of information, or Carl going off and just blasting out a really good cover of Journey? You know, should the creators stop believing? How can we ensure that this actually trickles down? And really, what opportunity is there to create a cohesive ecosystem?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think we've entered into this new realm, you know, in the age of AI. And you mentioned the, you know, the John Oliver episode talking about AI slop, where, you know, I think the technology is moving so fast. And when we first kind of encountered the issue of kind of copyright within music, and when sampling came to be, and there were ways to use technology to create, even that seemed like, oh man, this is something really new. It's moving really quickly. It just takes a little while for, I think, the industry in which that technology exists, for everyone to kind of get their arms wrapped around it. And I think that, you know, with AI and the way that AI models are trained and whatever kind of creative content is going into that, there's such, the pace at which that's happening has been so lightning fast that it might take a little while for kind of the regulatory side to catch up. I think that it is catching up, and we kind of maybe want to take the lessons, or some of the lessons learned from what happened with sampling and music and other kind of, you know, creative rights as that evolved, and try to bake them into the way that we approach creative protections and copyrights, you know, within content, as we think about kind of AI and the models that are trained, and, you know, what the creative gets out of that, and how they can protect their own kind of likeness in this age where the machines are kind of outpacing the humans. I think I joked that it's like, you know, Terminator 2, there was Skynet with these killer robots, and they were trying to figure out how to, you know, stop that, you know, from happening in the future. And now we're kind of in this age where we have the Skynet piece, except it's not the Terminators. It's AI creating, you know, all this content, and the technology getting to the point where we have, the burden is on us to kind of to sift through and see how do we control this, and how do we tell what's real from what's not. And so I think that that's a very interesting, you know, place for us to be in right now.
I'd love to hear your view.
Yeah,
I know some archaic terms such as Napster were being thrown around in previous conversations, but
yeah,
I enjoy speaking to the archaic, actually. But Carl, as you were talking about that, it actually brought up an interesting point, actually a personal story, in that, you know, I remember sitting in a conference room about the time of the Napster case and the Grokster case, and talking about the, you know, Millennium Copyright Act. And, you know, there was a great deal of concern around the provenance of intellectual property that was being used on these BitTorrent sites, right? You know, I think Metallica is still angry at Napster, for that matter. But one thing I did do, that's right. That's what drives the music. Yeah. But I leaned over to a colleague of mine and sort of whispered in his ear and said, you know, if somebody could find a way to legitimize the intellectual property and create a sort of, you know, a licensing regime around this, and then offer the songs at a reasonable price point, you know, maybe that would legitimize this. Because obviously what Napster's shown us is there's a market for this. People love music, and they love the convenience of being able to access music over a digital platform. What if there's a way to legitimize this? This is a great opportunity. And, you know, and hey, presto, Apple Music comes along, you know, and now we have, you know, the Spotify's of the world and Amazon Music and what have you. So I think, you know, there's always an incredible amount of concern about making sure. I think what happens is there's always the demand. The demand finds a way with the new technology. And then it's later sort of left up to, you know, I'd humbly submit the IP professionals to find a way to legitimize it, to make sure that the right people are being properly rewarded for their innovations or, you know, creative efforts. And so there, I think here's another opportunity, right? You know, as with AI that we were seeing before with music. And I think that's discussed a lot in the cases or in the recent cases. But sorry, Carl, go ahead.
No, I was just thinking that like it's really just about kind of sitting there and saying what makes sense for everyone involved, you know, and trying to be fair and trying to get along, right? Not to be too idealistic, but you know, there is a something to be said for the fact that there's plenty of money, plenty of kind of recognition to go around. And I think it's just kind of getting that system and infrastructure in place to make that happen. And it took a while with like the, you know, the Napster thing, like you're talking about. I was in college at that point and I had a, you know, a high speed internet connection, and I was just not so much Napster, but like, you know, FTP servers and just downloading, you know, Grateful Dead shows and like by the scores. And I know that like when the whole like, okay, there's gonna be, you're gonna have to pay for this, it was like, oh man, like even this is now I'm not getting it for free anymore. But you gotta really step back and think about it, you know, from the big picture and what the right thing to do is in terms of the artist or whoever it is that's got the creative content. And I think that we've come to a place where we have a pretty good model there. And hopefully, like you said, that's gonna, you know, that kind of thing is gonna translate over to what we're looking at with copyrights in the IP world and whatnot. So it's a very interesting point.
What I think is interesting, what you just said, is in the past, we were the scrapers. We being the humans, the people were the ones downloading the torrents, downloading the music. Now you have entities scraping this for a certain need. And it's
That's
easy
true.
back then to track via an IP address and see what it was that was downloaded. You can pin it to something. At the conference I was at last week, there were some discussions around fair use, and with the Getty images, I believe one of the outcomes in terms of getting some of the charges dropped was a filter where you would say, I don't want any images to be curated off of trained data from Getty images, which was supposedly enough to placate some of the charges and getting those dropped. But in a sense, how can we then look at this next generation and tokenize it? And a lot of things, you know, blockchain has been thrown around a lot, but can it be a sort of, you know, digital stamp or a way that you can track the input of your training data? Because I know we were discussing here in Europe, I'm based in London, I can opt out of Meta AI training and I opted out. But in the US, the opt out process is you can opt out, but sorry, you can't. And a lot of that is being used. So how can the little guy go up against Goliath, digital watermarks, cryptography, tokenization? What do you see? And I'm asking you, Sean, as an opportunity to, because like last time you said, hey, there's an opportunity here to monetize this. What do you think would be a good way to at least get the ball or the thought going on taking some control as content.
You know, maybe I'm being overly idealistic here, and JP, you've definitely got a closer eye onto the, you know, the technical details. But, you know, I think there is an opportunity here for across the AI industry rather to sort of implement this idea of sort of IP provenance or data provenance. I know you were talking about data transparency in one of your previous IP Rally episodes, and it really sort of caught my ear. You know, I think there's an opportunity here to create the mechanism. I think if you look even at the summary judgment order in the Meta case, you know, the judge, you know, let the fair use defense stand in Meta's favor. But if you know, you actually read some of the obiter there, you know, he's really talking a lot about, well, you know, if we could show that there was economic harm, there's no reason why these companies can't create some sort of mechanism that traces the IP provenances and properly, you know, rewards creators for that or properly protects their intellectual property rights. So, you know, I think it's a relatively easy solution, but I think it's also a question of, you know, does the AI industry in general, you know, who basically has a requirement to import all of, you know, these mass amounts of data and scrape the internet to sort of create these models that are, you know, highly profitable. Do they see this as an opportunity to sort of get ahead of the problem and create a licensing regime? Or is it one where, you know, unfortunately, which we saw in a lot of the early days of the internet and file sharing, you know, it's going to come down to a question of, you know, is this something that's going to have to be fought out in the courts before everyone, you know, considers whether or not that, you know, what the real penalties are, and what the parties want to bring to the table. And also, you know, as somebody who works in licensing, every transaction is separate and unique, right? But I think here, and here's where I am strictly speaking in a personal capacity, you know, maybe there is an opportunity to sort of automate this or find, you know, find some way to create values. Maybe that's done through copyright clearinghouses. I'm not sure. I'm not speaking as a copyright attorney in any capacity. But I think there's opportunity here. I think there's opportunities here for good data, clean data versus slop data going into these AI models. And I think it's a cost that's probably worth bearing, considering the amount of funding these companies are getting and considering how they are basically, you know, shaping the future of how people consume data, at least over the internet.
Yeah, you know,
I'll leave it there, you know.
To kind of tack on, and you have me thinking, like, do we think it's a matter of kind of education with those that are in the positions of making these decisions as to are they privy to the models, and how much do they need to know about the stuff that we're talking about right now in order to actually kind of figure out what that is going to look like? You know, is it?
I think that's a great point, Carl, right? Because I think the creative community sees the threat here, or perceived threat, or at least they see an environment where they don't feel they're being properly remunerated for their intellectual property. I mean, if you look at royalty rates over Spotify versus royalty rates over, you know, radio, you know, it's tenths of a penny, right? You know, so, you know, the only way to successfully license your music across the internet is really, you've got to find a secondary way to make that money. And I think that's why, I mean, I do, again, in my spare time, I put on house concerts for artists, you know, and I really enjoy it. It's sort of a great way to sort of give back to the artistic community, because I don't share your, I play, Carl, but I'm certainly not at your level. I'll admit that.
I was going to say that sounds like something down here in LA so far sounds that they do these house concerts. There's a series of them. Man, we got to get my Steely Dan cover band Illegal Fun up to your area and play one of them. We just did a run of shows in Ponce this past weekend. We did three nights in a row. We're digressing now. This is where the music part comes in. That's really cool that you do that. That's cool.
But again, you find these bands now. I mean, for me, it's someone my age, you know, it's great. I can watch any legacy band any day of the week because they're on these eternal tours, right? You know, I mean, you know, I think the Psychedelic Furs have been on a tour for 20 years. But I mean, the point is that this is how they're being remunerated, right? You know, they have to go back to touring. They have to go back to merchandising because, you know, the way people are consuming their music, primarily, they're just not getting a fair shake, or they don't feel that they're making a fair shake.
Right. You know, it's merch sales, it's ticket sales, it's virtual, like paying to see live streams of bands that are on tour, right?
Yeah.
Like $25, $30 to do that. And, you know, there used to be physical kind of, you know, product where you had, you know, margin on that, like in the form of records and tapes and CDs, and that could all get kind of cut out to these artists. But you're right, you know, it's in the digital sense, it's, you know, there's pennies on the dollar, you know, being made. So it does force this other kind of, you know, dynamic with trying to kind of, you know, recoup that. And I think trying to relate that to what we're talking about within like this space,
I think the way I click the dots, that's a new one, connect the dots. Sure. Let's not edit that out then. Is that, you know, we're seeing obviously the Getty versus Stability, Disney versus Midjourney. They're massive, and they're the ones that own the rights to a lot of music. you have Taylor Swift re-recording her entire portfolio to take ownership of her music. So the small guys don't have that ability to own it necessarily, because you may need to sell your soul to the devil in a way to get that exposure. So to kind of take that, it's, you know, what's the intention of the Gettys, of the Disneys, versus the true intention of an artist? I was thinking, you know, is Disney wanting to ensure that they have the right to use their intellectual property in an AI to corner the market? Or are they fighting for the small guys and girls and small players to give them the right?
I think it's a bit of both, maybe, right? I think, you know, I one thing I'd like to say, JP, I think we sit in an interesting place as IP professionals and as technologists, as, you know, as you and Carl are, where, you know, there's an opportunity here to sort of redress the balance, particularly in how AI content is being consumed, to where, is it human invention? Is it machine invention? You know, to what extent, you know, do we want to obviously value the great contributions that are brought by AI to industry, but also, you know, making sure we're still protecting the rights of the individual creator, the individual inventor. You know, I mean, this is something we talk about in patent licensing all the time, right? You know, that it's important that we still have a society that rewards individual invention and human creativity. As AI sort of creates more tools around that to quote unquote enable it, or even quote unquote over, suppress it, I suppose. Where's the balance, and where should we stand as people whose job it is to enforce the intellectual property rights?
Yeah, because as you know, IP is a human right. But if the future of IP is AI created, what happens to that right?
You know, I don't know if we want to get into this too deeply, but, you know, there is sort of a wider philosophical question around the importance of human effort, you know, to achieve this. You know, what is the output of intellectual labor, and what's the value of learning, you know, certain skills so that you're able to create these talented outputs, right? I mean, I can enter a three word prompt into an AI tool, and it'll pop out an image, pop out a short film, it'll, you know, pop out a short song for that matter. But have I invested the time, you know, to actually learn those skills? Now, arguably, learning how to correctly prompt an AI is transformative, and, you know, and creates something new. That seems to be something that we're currently, you know, grappling with in the case law. But, you know, just overall, the value of effort to learn a new skill and to be able to actually point to the amount of struggle that you put into the end product. You know, again, we're getting more into philosophy here, but I think it is something that's very important to the human experience, and I think that underlies, you know, the reason why intellectual property rights are so important, right?
Well, it comes down to the premise of patents, in a sense. It needs to be inventive. It needs to be non-obvious. So somebody that's a subject matter expert needs to look at it and say, "You need to be that subject matter expert. You need to spend the time to be that expert," like looking at some of the films, like you look at a Citizen Kane or a Vertigo, and then you look towards like a Godfather. Do you think Francis Ford Coppola just put in a few prompts to come up with some of the scenes and the photography aspect? I'm like, my day joy, you guys are musicians, I love photography, you know, the framing of it. You think Ansel Adam went out to the, you know, to the wilderness and take these outstanding photos just so somebody can say, "Make my grandma look like Ansel Adams"? And no. So I wholeheartedly agree with that point.
Yeah, I was going to add to that, you know, this concept of the amount of time put into the prompting, right? And it is important. It's philosophical. But I mean, I was at a show, an event a couple of months ago, and former head of the USPTO was speaking about prompt engineering and how important that is, and familiarizing yourself with that, because that is important, right? Because you're still, you know, you're still getting something out of a human being knowing to go in and put the right prompts in and to get more granular and contextual with how they're prompting. And I, you know, you're still at its source, there's still a human being actually prompting the AI to do what it's doing. And that is a very, you know, important skill to kind of carry into kind of the next wave of how these tools are going to impact this industry. So, I mean, yeah, like I said, it's philosophical, but I just still think it's very important. And when you have someone talking, you know, at a trade show about that on stage and saying, guys, this is something you need to learn how to do. I think it's, you know, it's important.
Well, you know, and I'd push that back, you know, on Carl, you and JP. I mean, IP Rally as a tool creates an incredible amount of convenience for practitioners, right? You know, you're able to very efficiently, you know, go about a prior art search, for example, right? So there's 100% value in what IT tools are being able, you know, to deliver. And, you know, there's a lot of value to the creative community, you know, being created by, and efficiencies being built by these IP tools. So, you know, I don't think it's a question of, you know, I don't think it's, you know, unfortunately, we typically see things in binary terms, but I think AI as a tool, incredibly valuable. AI as a creative assistant, incredibly valuable. But, you know, let's make sure we manage the inputs and the outputs correctly so that we still respect human, you know, human creativity, I suppose.
Well, that's the thing, right? Can we do it responsibly?
Yeah. You know?
Whether it's, you know, generative AI or, you know, and I talk to people about this all the time, you know, it's like, okay, well, using it as a resource and using it as a way to learn, right? Like that's, but I mean, look at what we've done with like social media and some of the other things where, you know, we can't tell what's real from what's not. And,
well,
you
know. Yeah.
But it also comes down to, also you guys were saying the word efficiency. And one of the subjects that's also come up is efficient infringement. That's just curious to see your view on that.
Oh, if you don't, I'll jump in on that because I'm kind of fired up around efficient infringement because it comes up every day in what we do in licensing, right?
We want to hear from you here, so this is perfect.
Okay. You know, I mean, it's interesting, right? I think in both the Midjourney case and the Meta case, you've got an example where, at least in the Meta case, their head of AI, you know, discussed and was considering going out to the publishing houses to negotiate licenses for the data inputs, but then they weighed the difficulty of doing that against the ease of being able to access that data through quote unquote shadow libraries, which are basically BitTorrents. And you know, they rolled the dice, they took the risk, and they decided that was the more efficient way of going about building that model. I think this goes back to what we were talking about in the beginning. You know, perhaps if there was a better way of sort of managing IP provenance along the line to where there was an efficient way that, you know, content creators could feel they're actually being properly remunerated for that, maybe that you know, the BitTorrent shouldn't be a viable option to build these tools. But then all, you know, but again, you know, you're dealing with a universe where the people creating these tools are getting a lot of funding to develop them. They're also, I would argue, cognizantly aware of the IP value of what they're ingesting. But, you know, when they look at the cost and inconvenience involved, you know, they'd rather take the risk and weigh, you know, err on the side of efficient infringement, which is a business decision, right? I mean, I'm not arguing the validity of that one way or the other, when you've got to make a business decision on cost and convenience. Personally, I would come down on the side of enforcing strong intellectual property rights. But again, I'll leave it there.
JP, I think you had a follow up.
No, it's just with the just so many use cases and examples, and you know, it really comes down, like you do have the David versus the Goliath, and I think a great example is there's a Tracy Chapman with Fast Car. She's for 30 years refused for anybody to cover copy, or, and she went after a few artists, you know, respectfully asserting her intellectual property right. Do we think that she would have the same opportunity if it wasn't a song that she owned and she was very comfortable going litigiously to protect her right to the existing environment where maybe the other side doesn't care, or they feel that there's mechanisms in place that they can delay or deflect? And this comes down to the track. And can you prove that it was used to train your model? You can prove that the song was copied. Not going to do a Vanilla Ice impression, but we all know that the example. You know, how can, you know, we look into this in a modern lens? You know, what sort of rights to actually enforce do some artists have? We can see the Disneys and the Gettys using their might. I'm not going to say right, their might to enforce, but what mechanisms are in place to let the next generation's Tracy Chapmans protect their IP?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, I brought up the, I mean, they're not tiny, but, you know, the Sonos versus Google example and them trying to enforce, you know, their IP, and they've been going back and forth now for, you know, years, and there was a decision made and it was appealed, but it was like, they're one of the kind of smaller guys looking to represent the kind of rights of those who have developed really strong IP that have allowed them to kind of exist in that space and thrive as an audio company. As you know, for those of you not familiar with Sonos, multi-room wireless audio over Wi-Fi. I think maybe most of our listeners would probably be familiar with it, but be surprised. I have musician friends that don't know what it is. And I'm like, who are you? What, really? but it, you know, it's not everyone has the ability to do that. And, you know, we all know how this works with, you know, licensing and settlements and, you know, what the kind of how that all figures into the strategy of a company who, you know, is infringing or, you know, is looking to kind of, you know, push the, you know, throw the ball down the road or whatever the saying is. I know I'm messing that up. My synapses are not firing today the way that I want them to, but I think that that's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting thing where maybe it will take more of that to change things. And, you know, you look at like Metallica versus like Napster and like all those different kind of points in time where someone stood up and raised their hand and said, hey, this is not cool. How much of that is needed in order for there to be change?
Well, I think the industry is watching this Disney Midjourney case with a lot of interest, right? And I think it's going to be, you know, seeing how this thing turns out. Now, the interesting thing is I'm not a betting man, and I'm not going to place any bets here, but there's a very high probability that this might be settled out of court with a licensing deal, right? And so at that point, we may not have, you know, any definitive ruling from a court, you know, telling us whether, you know, Midjourney's rights are infringing copyright or not, you know, or what's the validity of their fair use defense in developing their AI models and inputs and outputs. But it would be great if there were, or at least some development in the law of, you know, regulations around this.
Yeah, because I think the Getty comment on, you know, filtering out, that means that the traceability exists.
Well, yeah.
The traceability is there. So how much is it intent versus just mechanisms that are new? Because, you know, there was the what was it, 1,000, the 11,000 artists with the open letter warning about the threats of AI. But, you know, bringing us to the imagine if topic, you know, imagine if we get it right.
Oh.
What impact will that have? But on the flip side, imagine if we get it wrong. What impact will that have on future innovation in a sense of creation? And for those watching, I've been distracted because Cosmo, a previous guest of the Rallycast, is in the office with me today. And it's 6:30 here in London, so he needs to make an appearance. So.
Well, if we get it, so, hey, Cosmo, how you doing, buddy? Hey, if we get it wrong, it's just kind of like going to be what it's like right now, right? I mean, it's going to just be messier for longer. And that hopefully is enough motivation to get it right. What if we get it right? And Sean, I'm interested to hear kind of your take on that.
No. I completely agree, Carl. Again, you know, we started the podcast off sort of talking about every challenge is an opportunity, right? You know, maybe here is an opportunity to find ways to get this right. I think IP or data provenance and data transparency are concepts that are going to become increasingly important as AI becomes more, a central part of, you know, how people interact with data content, you know, interact with everything, right, for that matter. How we interact with each other, for that matter, right? You know, I mean, I've read recently of people who use ChatGPT in their day-to-day communications to look smarter, right? You know, I mean, it's interesting, but, you know, but sometimes people on the receiving end of that don't feel they're having a genuine communication with someone, you know, a genuine conversation with someone.
How do you know it's ChatGPT curated? You know, it could be just a well-worded email.
I think the giveaway, JP, is usually where the response from someone seems a lot more erudite than what you typically hear from someone, and you call them out on it. That's what I've heard. Yeah, so.
Could be responding to a message after a few at the pub.
You know, yeah, exactly. Properly lubricated responses. Yeah, I mean that could be it as well. AI assistance by other means, I suppose. But, you know, and I think, you know, you have to look at that in whatever the current legislative environment is. I don't, you know, looking at what happened in the early days of the internet, I'm not sure how willing industry is to want to incorporate sort of top-down, you know, legislative measures around this. I see a lot of companies talking about wanting to self-regulate in all of these spaces. But maybe it's a combination of making sure the right people are at the table and developing these solutions, right? There was a recent article by Matteo Sabatini from Sysvel, you know, where he was talking about the importance of having IP professionals at the table in drafting and working with government, you know, to draft these solutions and draft these regulations.
And then that comes to another, you know, existential question. Do we wait for regulatory improvement? Or does the industry or the creatives take it on themselves? And what risks or opportunity does it have? Because I think a lot of innovation could come from creatives and individuals finding a solution to the problem, such as, you know, Getty with stability getting, you know, a filter in. But how much of that would drive then, you know, let's say the nefarious intentions of certain governmental agencies throughout the world, depending on where they're based? And Cosmo agrees with this one, you know, whose best interest do they have in mind? You know, Carl's and yours, or donors, etc.
Well, you know, in China,
down that line, I'll go.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, JP. I mean, you know, in China, for example, you know, they've seen the competitive need to improve their AI as, you know, their industrial dominance in artificial intelligence modeling. So they've essentially agreed that, well, you know, we'll hold IP right. I'm simplifying this incredibly, but I mean, basically the feeling there is, you know, we'll tone down the balance for intellectual property enforcement in order to ensure that these AI models are being built, you know, quickly. I think in the United States, I think the content creators such as Disney, such as Getty, for example, who's been really good at enforcing their intellectual property right in this space, they see a potential threat. They see a change in the way their content, their content is being generated by AI, and they see infringement. But I think for right now, you know, the best solution they see is to work this out through the courts.
Which brings you to the, you know, public perception. Midjourney was popular, and then Disney came in, and now public opinion is on potentially Midjourney's side. So
yeah.
How much does that affect, regulatory desire, or obviously not the lawyer's intentions, always to go down the litigious route. But what potential detrimental impact could it have long term on those that could be spun towards being?
And Carl, I'll jump in really quickly on this if you don't mind. I mean, one thing I think we find is there are those who, whenever they see a large company enforcing their intellectual property rights, sort of would say, you know, that's just sort of an example of a very well-funded litigious corporation enforcing their intellectual property right to the detriment of the wider community. And there's a lot of calls often for, let's go back to the days of the early 2000s and open innovation. And, you know, those were spirited great times, and certainly a lot of creative technology came out of that. What I would say, though, is that, you know, my only counter argument to that is, even if you're agreeing to openly license your creative output or technology or code without the expectation of remuneration, or with the expectation of use throughout a community, that's still a licensing decision, right? You're still making a conscious decision to do that. You know, Moby, for example, he's just created this website where he's licensed out all these music files for free for people to use. But one of the requirements he has is that it can't be used by any organization that's promoting eating meat, right? Because he's a vegan, and as a content creator, I feel he's well within his rights to do so and have some control as to how his creative output is being used. And again, as a licensing individual, right? Yeah, you know, I see that as the opportunity. You know, first of all, I see it's important to go out there and defend the rights of people who are creating inventions and artistic works, but also that there is hopefully a way to negotiate these rights in a way that both parties, or all parties, may come away a little bit dissatisfied, but actually feel that that there's a workable solution.
Yeah. You know, I think it is interesting to think about how it's going to happen, whether it'll be like, you know, top down or bottom up, or like some combination of the two. As a kind of, you know, we're still kind of in the paradigm shift of that, and you know, we're talking about imagine if and what the future will look like, but you know, it's hard to tell. It's a pretty complex thing to tackle, so you know, we'll just have to sit back and see what happens.
Yeah, and having to do with music, ironically, it's those that make the most noise that get the most attention. But what are the intentions? Like, let's say an example with a, you know, catalog that potentially is copied in a way. Do you speak up when there's success around the use of that IP? Or do you speak up because of the use of the IP? And is it a money grab in a way that's driving this desire to be more track based? Or is that when they heard of it? So, you know, it's because there's so much more content out there, and a lot of it is this AI slop, to use Oliver's term. How do you separate the real from the bad? How do you separate the good intention from the bad intention? You know, what is driving in the end?
That's a question, right? And I do think it is kind of, once something gets on the radar with a lot of people and becomes popular, you know, rises to the surface, and that's when someone raises their hand and says, hey, wait a second. You know, it's so much of it exists without it kind of popping out into the zeitgeist, so to speak. And like, what will it take? You know, like, at what point is it? And to your question, JP, is it about the money, you know, the cash grab, or is it really about like making sure that we're doing what's right? And does the decision to kind of raise the hand come before, you know, something, you know, rises to the surface like that? And I think that just really depends on, you know, who it is that feels like they're not, like they're getting the short end of the stick. And you know, I think we'll continue to see it play out that way. Will there be, you know, numerous examples? But it is, you know, it's a very complex, very big thing. To try to figure out and tackle, and you know, figure out the answers. But interesting to think about.
Yeah, absolutely.
If we go back to Metallica, a lot of people may think, oh, they're massive, they have everything they want. Why do they care so much? But a lot of effort went in for them to be where they are. And I feel that their argument back in round one, let's say, whichever round it was back then, was really on, there was a lot of effort in this. We need to be remunerated for it. You don't do anything for free. That's the same argument now. So why is history repeating itself? What lessons can be learned?
Well, it's because we're humans.
Are we though? No, just kidding.
there's this Fish song, Blaze On. It's like a newer one, but one of the refrains in it is, because when I screw up once, I do it two more times. And it's like, it's kind of how it is, Sean, you were going to say something.
No, I think to some extent what we've seen, and I mean, we work in Silicon Valley, people are in, or people are always rushing very quickly to in a highly competitive environment to come up with new solutions. And oftentimes questions of IP licensing, question of proper remuneration, question sometimes questions of being entirely compliant with all the regulations are sort of left to the wayside in the interest of getting a return for your shareholders or return for your VC investment. I think technology loves a vacuum, I guess is what I would say. And maybe, it's up to us as, again, as individuals who sort of work both in the technological space but also in the intellectual property space to make sure that, the value of innovation is still being realized. And that we're still standing up for the corporate, corporate the rights of corporations who have duly invested and developed these technologies. If I could, I could bring it back to TiVo, one of the previous companies of Adia that I was working for. We developed a lot of solutions that were foundational to DVR recording, but later found itself into the way that content was distributed over the, video content was being distributed over the internet. And, we still felt that that technology is foundational and those patents were valid. And, we enforced our IP rights there. I'm sure when Disney sees Darth Vader being used, as an output up to a Midjourney prompt, they're seeing a little bit of their investment, being used without their proper remuneration. And I understand that. Maybe it is through, unfortunately, maybe it is through litigation. Hopefully, I always think if we can properly negotiate these rights, then we've achieved a solution. But it's going to be, I think we've still got some experience. Carl, to your point, we're going to make the same mistake twice, I think, before we get it right. It's going to take a lot of effort from professionals in the IP industry.
Well, why do we love to litigate so much? It's just such a headache. In any sense of law, litigation is just word. Just it gives me, just kind of like makes me, shake a little. It's like it just, it's complex. It's back and forth. It just doesn't make sense. I mean, I know it does, obviously, or else it wouldn't exist. But again, idealistic, but on a basic level, just to me, I would love to see it be a top down, okay, here's how we can regulate this. Here are some examples where we can learn from how this happened, and let's apply them here and
Yeah,
then make it cool for everybody.
I entirely agree, Carl. And again, I think it's getting the right voices at that table that's really key. I mean, you can look at sort of the example of the EU's recent, attempt to regulate standards essential patents, right? And certainly the companies who were responsible for developing that standards, those that standards. Those standards-based technologies didn't feel that they were given a fair consideration at the table when those laws were being developed, right? So it's we need to increase, we need to ensure that the right committee, the right discussions are being had around that, I think.
brings to kind of closing reflections in the sense of I have an idea of what my imagine if would be. You know, I said before a few times, imagine if we get it right, imagine if we get it wrong. But to take a page out of Carl's book, imagine if we take two steps forward instead of two steps back.
Yeah, that's entirely right, JP. Yeah.
I'd like to ask each of you, Carl, what would you say your imagine if is based on this conversation?
You stole mine. That's can I just tack onto that and say, yeah, I mean, like, you know, what would it look like? Imagine if it was two steps forward. Imagine if, I guess, it was something that was a top down approach and there were rules of engagement and it was fair for everyone, you know, which I think would be a couple steps forward. But I think that's where I'm at with it too. You know, definitely along the lines of, you know, what JP mentioned. Sean, your turn.
I think, and again, hopefully I'm not dwelling too far into science fiction, but, you know, I think maybe we're already here, is that, you know, I think we're really getting to a point where data provenance is something we really need to think about. I think in the way that we're sort of, if you look at, you know, social media has definitely been a boon for society, but, you know, one could argue it's created some societal harm as well in the absence of maybe constructive regulation around it. Maybe again, here we have an opportunity when you look at AI slop, when you look at the way that how easily reality can be distorted, you know, particularly if you're looking at it through an electronic device, which is the primary way people are engaging with media these days. Maybe here is an opportunity to hopefully get it right, you know, not only for rights holders, but, you know, maybe for society in general, to where we're finding some way to ensure that what we're consuming is, you know, properly licensed or at least verifiable information versus something that's completely made up by a machine.
Yeah, and I think society awareness, because a lot of times you don't care until it gets too close to home. You know, a lot of times people think that there isn't a human on the other side of this. It isn't the Metallicas, it's the Carls that in the end can suffer. So it's really just trying to look at it with a human point, not a doom scroll point. Because like we said, IP is human. And once you remove the human from it.
And I think that's it, JP. I think that's it. You know, are we in the business of rewarding human creativity and innovation or aren't we? You know, and, you know, that I would definitely, hopefully, land on the side of supporting human creativity. So,
Carl, tell the listeners your tour schedule when you're playing next.
No, you know, I gotta say,
he's playing my backyard in 2 weeks.
I'm absolutely gonna reach out to you, Sean. Thanks for giving me that little nugget. I appreciate that. There's six of us though, so I hope you got space.
That's cool. Yeah.
No, you know, honestly, I'm 43 years old, so you know, I'm not that old. But I got home and we did three shows, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and I got home and I was like, man, I am exhausted. Like, we gotta spread it out a little bit. But actually what we're doing with that band is we're gonna take a little beat and get some new material spun up. And I think we're looking to do like a Halloween gig where we'll probably cover like an entire Steely Dan record during one set and then do like mixed hits in another set or something like that. But
oh, cool. It'll
be fun. Yeah. Until then, it'll just be, you know, in the studio working on various other things with the guys I share a studio with here in LA. So it'll be fun.
Just going to say, Carl, you need to make sure you give proper reference to old Dan there.
So Steely Dan.
Was it copyrighted and recorded originally by
him? I know. If Donald Fagen hears this podcast, I'm going to get sued.
Yeah, so thank you so much, Sean and Carl, obviously, for your time, and Cosmo here as a guest. Really enjoyed this session. I know we can probably talk for another hour about this. So please do reach out if you have any questions, if you have any ideas for any future episodes. It's the summer break coming ahead here, which in Europe we'd love to take advantage of. So just look out for some rally shorts upcoming, and the next episode will probably be coming after the summer break. But Thank you so much for making it this far. And if you have any ideas or any thoughts on what we've been talking about, don't hesitate to reach out to us either via LinkedIn or directly via either IP Rally or Sean over at Adeia. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you for listening and looking forward to seeing you on the next episode.
Hey, thanks for having me. It was a real pleasure. Take care.
Thanks for being here, Sean. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.